Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, writer Lisa Coe talks about her award-winning book, The Leavers. As the country debates what should happen to undocumented immigrants and their U.S.-born children, Coe uses fiction to take up the issue at a micro level. The Leavers is the story of one boy, Deming Guo, whose mother doesn't return from her nail salon job one day and who ends up in the care of white college professors. They mean well, but they have no clue how much Deming is traumatized by his removal from his mother and the culture of his neighborhood in the Bronx. We'll talk about Coe's decision to make her characters both good and flawed, strong and weak, and we'll hear about how her own experiences as one of the only non-white kids in her suburban New Jersey childhood played into this book. Our conversation starts after a short break. Thing about undocumented immigrants. Just about every American has an opinion about how their presence is affecting the country and whether they should be forced to leave or allowed to stay. But often our conclusions are based on who we imagine these people are rather than any firsthand experience. Almost by definition, undocumented immigrants are hidden from view, and for many of us, they're hard to really know as human beings. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Novelist Lisa Coe won the Penn Bellwether Prize for Fiction and was a finalist for the National Book Award for her book, The Leavers. It's the story of a U.S.-born boy named Deming Guo. He's being raised in the Bronx by his mother, who's an undocumented immigrant from China, and a kind of extended family he's not actually related to. That becomes a problem after Deming's mother, Polly, fails to come home from work one day. No warning, no note, no further contact. Eventually, Deming is adopted by a couple of college professors who rename him Daniel Wilkinson as if they could erase his Chinese identity and bestow their white privilege just by wishing it. Like the millions of stories of real families of undocumented immigrants, this story is complicated, but it offers at least one vision of what life might be like for people like Deming and Polly. The Leavers is available now in paperback. Lisa Coe, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
You'd been following stories in the news of undocumented immigrants for a number of years. How did this family, Deming and Polly and the people in their circle, how did they form in your mind as you started working on the book?
Well, the initial inspiration was actually a New York Times article I'd read back in 2009, so nearly 10 years ago now. And that sort of sparked my interest. It was a story about an undocumented Chinese immigrant whose name was Xu Ping Jiang. She'd been found in a Florida detention prison, immigration prison, for nearly 2 years. And she had a son that she had tried to bring into the U.S. They had gotten separated, and he had gotten adopted by a Canadian couple. So I started reading a lot more and finding out about all these other stories where this was happening, not only to women from China, but from immigrants all across the world who were being separated from their U.S.-born children. And it seemed to really horrify me. It shocked me. I wasn't aware that it was happening. But it was also sort of part of this long continuum, this practice of separating families that's been done in the U.S. and globally as a way to assert power and to kind of terrorize populations.
Well, it is something to be afraid of, right? If you're afraid that going somewhere with your family could mean you lose your family, I suppose it's a disincentive, but there's so much collateral damage from that.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're seeing it more and more these days, too. I think the most recent statistics are that there are 7,000 parents of U.S.-born children who are being deported every month. So you can imagine the sort of really long-term reverberations that we'll have on so many people here.
I love that we first meet Polly through Deming's eyes, so we don't fully understand her. We know that she's his mother, she's kind of this tough cookie, but he knows that she loves her. Initially, we don't think much about her backstory because he doesn't. He's a kid, and his world is very much of the present moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a decision to frame it that way. It took me about 7 years to write the novel, and I kind of tried out all the different possibilities to how to structure the story. I knew going into it, I would have this mother and a son. They would be separated. The son would be adopted by a white family, and they would somehow find their way back to one another. But I didn't know really the best way to tell the story, and it started off from Polly's point of view and then moved into Deming's, and it was kind of shuffling around the scenes in a way to make it kind of strategically interesting for the reader, hopefully, too, to kind of find out more about Polly at the same time that Deming finds out more about his mother.
So there's the day when she doesn't come home from work, and they've been living with Polly's boyfriend and his sister and her son, who is a lot like a brother to Deming. none of the adults in his life initially, in Deming's life, seem to really notice that he is reeling emotionally. And we realize they have their own set of problems, but he's so alone. Like, he's got food to eat and a place to sleep, but nobody recognizes that he's a wreck.
Yeah, I mean, they're all really sort of in crisis mode. And it's also not clear at the very beginning why Polly left. If she left on purpose, if she was taken away, she's in danger. There's a storyline introduced in the very beginning where she's interested in a possible job opportunity in Florida, moving out of state. So, and she's also a woman with a great deal of wanderlust. She's very independent, quite restless, kind of talking about leaving New York City as well. So her family's aware of that, and they're wondering, maybe she left on purpose. Maybe she left without us. So there's that kind of mixed emotion and uncertainty about what happened to her in the start.
So when we do learn Polly's backstory, it's filled in such extraordinary detail, and suddenly we recognize her as this maverick. You know, we see her in a really different context. She went from this small village, she said, I'm going to move to the city. I'm going to be a woman who works in a factory, and I'm going to make some, you know, what, you know, given her circumstances, it's a good salary. And she takes all these risks, and we just sort of see her suddenly through the same prism that a lot of people see their own immigrant ancestors. We're so proud of how tough they were and how bold and how brave. And suddenly she's a fully formed human for us.
Yeah, and part of that is the decision, I think, to write her story in the first person while Deming's is in third. Yeah. Gives a little more of an intimate quality to her telling of her story. And it's also a bit of a testimonial. She's telling her story to her son, Deming, kind of explaining how she grew up and, you know, the decisions that she made. And you're right, she's definitely quite a maverick. She's a rebel in a lot of ways, too. As you mentioned, she was the first girl in her village in Southeast China to move to the big city when it first became legal for rural migrants to move to urban areas. So there's a lot of daring in that. And I think part of that, too, was kind of trying to figure out what kind of woman would take that enormous risk to move to a new country where she didn't know anybody, take that financial risk, take that physical risk and emotional risk. And it seemed to be that kind of character, somebody who really, you know, had that spirit, that sense of adventure, that sense of daring, as well as that economic need, right? So that all led to me kind of trying to build her character in the way that she's written.
You resist the temptation to make her a saint. She's a little impulsive at times. She initially, understandably, recognizes she's not ready to be a mother. She falls in love with Deming when he's born. She's trying her best, but sometimes her best isn't good enough. And I thought that made her really interesting in a way that if she was just an ideal human being, she wouldn't have been.
Right. And, you know, it is interesting. I mean, nobody is an ideal human being. And I think all of us.
Except
you know,
you and me, right?
Yeah, except you and me. Maybe you. I don't know about me. But yeah, you know, everybody, you know, we're humans, right? We make bad decisions. We make great decisions. We're capable of the entire spectrum of human emotion, right? And I think that makes for more interesting characters. It also makes for more complicated characters and storylines. And I was kind of, you know, maybe not fully consciously writing against type, but I feel like part of me has always felt a little frustrated about how women and especially mothers are portrayed in literature and in our culture. This idea that they have to be perfect all the time or that makes you a bad mom. That seems very unfair and also rather unrealistic, you know, and not allowing women to really express their true humanity. So, you know, I wanted to write Polly as somebody who was complicated and real and kind of always pushing up against these expectations that are put on her. That's sort of a big theme of the novel, for both for her and Deming. Other people kind of have these expectations on how they should live. For Polly, you know, her family and her community is always saying, well, women and girls should be this way. I know a lot of us can relate to that. And she's always kind of trying to push up against those boundaries. And for Deming, his family and his adoptive parents are kind of telling him a certain mode of success through academics. And that's something that he's also trying to figure out how to live on his own terms.
They were a little hard for me to embrace, despite the fact that I know that they were trying to do the right thing. They just make these bad decisions without realizing they're making bad decisions over and over. Like it's almost a throwaway line in the book, but they've taken him in, they've provided him, they have, you know, financial resources, and they're prepared to love him. But just something as simple as he keeps telling them that milk upsets his stomach, and we get the sense that maybe, like a lot of people, he's lactose intolerant, and they haven't looked this up and recognized that this could be a problem for him, and they grew up drinking milk, so they make him drink milk.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think it really speaks to the way that we tend to normalize our experiences. And I think for Peter and Kay, who are Deming's white adoptive parents, you know, they've grown up as the sort of majority in their communities, and everywhere they look, you know, from the culture they consume and the books they read, and you know, they've been centered their whole lives. So it's very difficult for them, I think, to look outside that point of view. It's not something they're used to. It's not something they've ever really had to confront before. And, you know, Deming, for him, he's also very traumatized and confused about what happened to his mother, why he's suddenly in this new community, and they can't communicate in the way that they should be able to.
Yeah, even when they, you know, there are some questions about his language skills. He's been living in the U.S. for years. His English is fine, but there's sort of discussion over, like, how articulate he'll be in English.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was kind of my way of speaking to how Asian Americans are always seen as foreign, even if our families might have been here for four or five generations. And one of the things that I was kind of interested in exploring with the book is this kind of idea of an Asian American double consciousness, the way that we might see ourselves in one particular way, but other people might see ourselves in another way. And that's something expressed in the chapters where Deming's name is first changed to Daniel. He refers to himself as Deming. He sees himself as Deming. But everyone around him in his new school, his new family, new town says Daniel, right? So, you know, it's a way to sort of play with the idea of names and identity and name changes, and also just how America sees Polly and Deming as kind of different than how they see themselves. And how does that affect you when you know that people are looking at you in a certain way that isn't necessarily the right way?
Well, having a new name thrust on you, I mean, I can't imagine that there's anything more unsettling to your identity unless you've chosen that name for yourself.
Right. Yeah. And for Deming, that happens when he's 11 years old. I mean, his adoption story is quite atypical when he's grown up with his mother and he's already, you know, been living with her for 11 years. For Polly, I mean, she also changes her name. Her birth name is Palon, and her name change is something that's done out of empowerment, as opposed to Deming's name change, which is kind of done against his will. Polly changes her name from Palon to Polly when she first migrates to the U.S. It's kind of her way to claim a new identity, a new self, as she comes to a new country.
Deming's parents also don't understand what a jarring thing it will be for him to suddenly be one of the only non-white kids in his school.
Yeah, it's a really big change for him. He's coming from a place like New York City in the Bronx, which is very diverse, and all of a sudden he's the only Asian person in his entire town. And I think that speaks, you know, also to Peter and Kay's kind of racial and cultural blind spots. They kind of seem to assume that he'll be okay, that, you know, diversity is a good thing, but it's this kind of, you know, idea of diversity where they expect their child to perform that labor of diversity, but they're not really giving him the tools and support he might need.
I think a lot of white people assume, like, I have accepted you, therefore race doesn't matter.
Right.
Don't recognize that race always matters.
Yeah, it's that sort of colorblind attitude, right?
Yeah. And in order to be, like, better white parents of an adopted Asian kid, instead of talking to some Asians, they talk to another white couple who've adopted a daughter from China.
Yeah, they don't really have Asian friends or colleagues in their community to talk to. And their idea, too, I think, about what it means to be Asian is something that is very kind of static and singular. They see these children, they're who are Asian American, who are born in the U.S., as being kind of China, right? And so, you know, there's a scene where they take their children to these cultural camps for Chinese adoptees, where they kind of learn Chinese culture. It's this way of saying, well, we're teaching them their culture, we're connecting them to their culture, but these children are born in the U.S. Deming was born and raised in New York, so, you know, his culture is actually Chinese American, Asian American, American, New York, right? So it's a very different understanding of what that might mean for him.
My guest is writer Lisa Coe. She's a finalist for the National Book Award for her book, The Leavers. It's about the U.S.-born son of an undocumented Chinese mother raised by a white couple after his mother disappears. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lisa Coe about her novel, The Leavers. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Okay, so Deming, now Daniel, has been adopted by this white couple at the time when he's still thinking his mother could very well walk in the front door. He tries to sort of make the best of it. He ultimately comes to think of Peter and Kay as kind of parents to him, and they do care about him, and he cares about them. And the next time we meet him, he's we meet him in the book, and he's Daniel Wilkinson, which comes as a sort of jarring surprise. And I wonder if you can talk about choosing to surprise the readers with this chapter about Daniel, and it takes us a while to realize, oh, this is Deming.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I initially wrote the kind of inciting incident of the book was Polly leaving. Mm-hmm. That was kind of what started the entire drafting process. But as I started thinking more about Polly's story, I realized I also wanted to write her son Deming's story. And that was an important part of her story and kind of the way that the two of them are separated and try to find each other again was part of it. So in order to do that, I had to extend the narrative like 20 years in both directions, back to, you know, Polly's childhood and Deming's childhood, and then Deming as a young adult. And I wanted to kind of show the impact of, you know, what it was like for him to grow up without her, to have that shift when he's 11 years old into this new family, this new self, this new identity, and the loss, I guess, that it gives him, but also the gains. Like, it kind of, you know, the initial court cases and the news stories I was reading about it kept talking about this idea of who is a better fit for the children who were adopted. It felt there was a lot of coded language there. You know, these adoptive American families that were mainly white and middle class were seen as a better fit because they had, I'm assuming, economic resources, financial resources, education. I wanted to kind of explore that. What does that really mean? Is it really true? Deming, you know, as Daniel Wilkinson gets to go to college, is raised in a fairly economically privileged life in a hometown, receives a good education, but he's not particularly happy or fulfilled. There's still that sort of loss in him that something is not complete because of the loss of his mother and what that means to him.
Yeah, when we meet him as a young adult, he's kind of a mess, actually.
He is. He's definitely a mess. Yeah.
You also didn't make him the stereotypical Chinese-American kid who's really good at school. I wonder if that was something that just, even when you were a child, if it bothered you that people made assumptions about you just based on your family name.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the, you know, little experiences that Deming has growing up in his adoptive town are emotionally based on my experiences growing up in a fairly white suburb in New Jersey. I think I particularly gave his parents that profession of being professors because I wanted to play with that idea of education making them a better fit, you know, and I wanted to give Deming something to also like fight against. His parents definitely see school and academia as a particular path for him. And he's a musician, you know, he's an artist. He's kind of trying to rebel against that. But at the same time, he wants to please his adoptive parents. They're his only family, you know, so he loves and cares for them as well. And so that makes it a little difficult for him to figure out what to do next.
You give him this conflict as a musician because he's working with his childhood best friend that he made when he moved to the suburbs. They do care about each other. They have really different ideas about the kind of music they want to make. And time and time again, through much of the book, it's Deming who acquiesces to something that isn't quite right.
Yeah. He's, you know, he's in a place where he's grown up with so much loss. And I think there's a certain sense that he fears being abandoned.
Yeah.
His mother, you know, abandoned him, not by her own doing, but, you know, for him, it was a great psychological abandonment. And so he knows that he wants to please the people in his life. At the same time, he's not being true to himself. So he's kind of failing them as well as himself. So his journey is really trying to figure that out. You know, what does it mean for him to be true to himself, to kind of, you know, stand up for himself, and create that sense of family and belonging, I think, that he's looking for.
He's also put a lot, he's had to invest a lot of emotional and mental energy into keeping this big secret from his parents, which is that he's got a real problem with online gambling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, gambling is one of the themes, I think, that takes place throughout the book. There's a couple gambling and casino themes. I was thinking of the kind of risk-taking and kind of the theme of chance, I think, that comes with so many migration stories, being in the right place at the right time, or inversely, the wrong place at the wrong time. And Deming is a bit of a risk-taker, I think, because of his feeling of being unmoored and uncertain in his life. So that leads him to kind of, you know, take these financial risks with poker and disappointing people in the process.
Are you the first generation of your own family born in the U.S.?
I am, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever allow yourself to fantasize, like, who would I be? What would my life look like if I had been born and raised in China?
Yeah, my parents are Chinese immigrants from the Philippines. So they were born and raised there. And migration goes back several generations in my family. But I definitely grew up thinking a lot of those themes, you know, luck coming back into it as well. You know, my parents came to the U.S. Separately, but in the mid-60s and early 70s. And so, you know, if they had come over several years earlier, it might have been impossible for them to come. It might, you know, before 1965 Immigration Act, it was really hard to migrate legally to the U.S. if you were not European. So these kind of questions of legality, I think, are part of a context that's always been changing in U.S. history. And it's something that I often thought about as well. You know, was I lucky to have been born and raised in the U.S.? And what were sort of the forces that led me to do that, right? My parents were middle class. They were able to come over on student visas, whereas a lot of recent immigrants who don't have that class privilege are not able to come across, come here legally. And they have to come undocumented. They have to take the risks that come with that.
Where does Filipino culture fit into your sense of yourself?
You know, I feel like there's a really long history of Chinese people living in the Philippines. So, you know, it's a bit of a mix in my family where I don't necessarily identify with mainland China. It's not a place that is really part of my family's recent history, whereas I grew up visiting the Philippines, visiting my grandparents who live there. My parents speak, you know, many different languages and dialects. So it was always kind of a mix for us.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. First up, we have Tara calling from Fort Worth. Hi.
Hi. I had a question for the author regarding, really, her book appears to be a commentary on adoption and racial sensitivity and those sorts of things. I wondered if she had any thoughts on how one might go about adoption cross-racially and doing that sensitively. And then as a follow-up to that, I was curious if disproportionate nature of minority groups being adopted out of things like foster care and adoptive parents being disproportionately white would affect kind of how she views that.
Thanks for your call.
Hi. You know, yeah, I think it was something that I was thinking about a lot while writing the book, too. I'm not an adoptee or an adoptive parent. So I really wanted to center the stories and the voices of people who had lived that experience. I guess my advice for anybody looking to adopt transracially would be to look at those stories and look at, you know, people who have grown up as transracial adoptees. What are they saying? What worked for them? What didn't work for them? And kind of let them take the lead on that.
So Polly's story is really interesting. Her transformation continues. So she goes from village girl to urban woman working in a factory to immigrant, sort of trying to pay off, you know, the people who smuggled her into the United States and just keep out of the sights of immigration. When she returns to China, she has the opportunity, despite a lot of trauma, to really decide who she's going to be. And she makes some radical decisions.
Yeah, she does. I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but she kind of has to survive. You know, she's in a place where she makes these decisions out of survival. She's alone. She needs to find a place to live and a place to work. And so, you know, what she decides for herself is just sort of what she needs to do. And I think she also, you know, experiences some form of, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder where she's telling herself a certain story in order to keep on living. And that might be kind of purposely not thinking about certain parts of her past.
It made me think about the way that, you know, context matters a lot to the extent that we think we know someone's potential, right? If you saw her sewing shirts in a factory, you would assume there was only one kind of future available to her. If you saw her later when she had reinvented herself, you would never believe that she came from such humble beginnings. It's the same person. There are stories like this, people like this all over the world and in every generation. And yet it's really easy for us to just assume that with a snapshot, we know someone's whole life and potential.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, that context you're talking about is really kind of what I wanted to look at with the book. And I think that's what fiction allows us to do. You know, we're able to kind of get into the minds of characters in ways that, you know, straight journalism might not allow us to do that, and kind of psychologically feel what they're going through and provide that sort of longer lens look at a person's life. You know, what led her to come here? What led her to leave? What are her dreams and hopes and fears?
Was there ever a time, you said the book took 7 years, were you stuck at points like you knew that you wanted to try something different, but you weren't sure what that was? I mean, as you were figuring out all these different iterations of how you might tell the story, was there like a crisis moment for you?
There were a lot of crisis moments. yeah, you know, I think writing a first novel, probably writing any novel, because every novel is different. So much of the process is trying to figure out, how do I write it? You know, structure, point of view, plot, those are all kind of craft issues that come up in terms of what you decide to do. So I originally wrote a scene where Polly was leaving, and I kind of built the novel from there. And many years into it, maybe around year 4 or 5, I realized that scene no longer really worked, that Polly would not have made the decisions she made, given the way her character had developed. And so I had to kind of decide to either go forward or to remove that scene and everything that came with it. And there was a terrible moment where I decided to delete like a year's worth of work.
Wow.
Yeah, in order to keep going. You know, it ended up being the right decision. And it allowed me to sort of make the strategic decisions on how to build the story from there and try to like create the sense of pacing, I think, that it needed.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Deleting a year's worth of work on a novel is an interesting sort of, there's a parallel to people who decide to pick up and leave the places they've known.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and I think the stories of people who are leaving and to come here are things that, like, I don't know, I feel like we need more context around them. Like, why do people leave? Why do they come to the U.S.? And also, what role does the U.S. have in other countries that might lead people to come here?
What do you think makes people American?
I think being here, you know? I mean, being in America makes you American. Doesn't matter how long you've been here. Whether or not you feel American is another story. Hmm. You know, I know there are a lot of people who have immigrated here, have even lived here for most of their lives, but still feel that they're not fully American because they feel culturally connected to their home country. And that's fine. You know, I think the flip side of that is also who gets to be seen as American. And that's something that I wanted to really look at in The Leavers. Who does America allow to be American?
Yeah, it's we get the sense that some people are somehow empowered to make the decision to declare you're American and you're not, when that's not the sort of deal we all agreed to when we created this country.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I think there's still this sort of misunderstanding that a lot of people who aren't white, who might be coming from immigrant backgrounds, who are people of color, aren't actually American. You know, and that's something that's even come up in conversation with the book, where people are like, oh, when you grew up, you know, were the rest of the people in your school American? And I'm like, but I'm American. Mm. The school was in America. We're all American. You know, what do you really mean by American?
What do you do with a lifetime of those? Of those accidental, like, really thoughtless questions? Like, how do you process those?
You know, one way to do it is to write a novel. Maybe not the most efficient way, but definitely, you know, using it in your art is definitely one way to process and to sort of have your voice be heard, I guess.
Did you have to push back against other people who thought this is how this novel should be? And did you have to sort of recognize that ultimately your vision of this work was the right way to do it?
You know, maybe that's sort of the advantage of writing a first novel. Nobody's really waiting for it but you, and maybe not even you sometimes. So I was always very kind of certain that I wanted to center Polly and Deming in the novel. Like, I wanted to write from their experiences. I felt their experiences weren't ones that are seen enough in literature, and I was very interested in them. So I knew kind of, I had a very, you know, the vision for the novel was always there. And I didn't really show it to that many people except for a few very, you know, trusted readers. So yeah, I was lucky to not really have any of that pressure, you know, to write it in a certain way.
I was also really taken with, he's a relatively minor character, but Polly's father reminds us of all the people who are left behind in countries of origin, and frankly, the sacrifices they make so that people can come here and be Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. I feel like not a lot of people talk about her father. And yeah, he's left behind in her home village when she comes to the U.S. And, you know, there's a great sense of, I think, grief and loss for people who are separated from their family. They're really each other's only family by so many miles. And due to Polly's documentation or citizen status, like, she can't go back. She can't go back when her father passes away.
My guest is novelist Lisa Coe. She was a finalist for the National Book Award for her book, The Leavers, about the U.S.-born son of an undocumented Chinese mother raised by a white couple after his mother disappears. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Lisa Coe about her National Book Award-nominated novel, The Leavers, about the U.S.-born son of a Chinese mother raised by a white couple after his mother disappears without explanation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Charlene calling from Dallas. Hi, Charlene.
Hi. I have a question. How would your story have differed if Polly had been Paul?
Oh, I love that question. I've never really thought about it. I always had her as a woman, I think, because so many of the stories that I was reading had mothers in them instead of fathers, although there are many that also have fathers in them. You know, I feel like it just was easier for me to write her as a woman. And I think that the theme of her kind of pushing up against sexism and patriarchy was something that felt really important. Without that, she would be a totally different character. And kind of her relationship to her son and her, you know, misgivings about parenthood as a father, and because of the way that we view fathers versus mothers, would be so radically different.
Her early days in New York when she's first heavily pregnant and then a new mother are so interesting because she's in, as a lot of, you know, newcomers to the country are, she's in like an apartment with I don't know how many other women, and they're all in bunk beds, and she's in a mat on the floor. And like her roommates let the baby stay and let her stay with the baby, but they have kind of varying sensitivity to, you know, her challenges as a mother with a young child. She has one girlfriend who just loves the baby, and she even looks at her and thinks, I am not quite that maternal.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of that is also just sort of, you know, her struggle at the time. She has to borrow $50,000 to come into New York from China. So she's really heavily in debt. She's working really long hours. Childcare is, you know, extremely expensive in New York. And so she kind of has to figure out how to make these decisions, you know, to stay in this apartment where, you know, her roommates also are dealing with their own challenges. A lot of them are also parents and working long hours. So she ends up sending her son Deming back to China so her father can take care of him for a few years. And that's something that I've heard has happened in many migrant communities. You know, it's a way for her family to provide free childcare and for her to be able to work longer without having to stay home with her child. And when Deming is old enough to come back to school, he flies back to New York. He's 6 years old, and they see each other for the first time since he was a baby.
I mean, it's no wonder that he has all these challenges, sort of feeling completely at home in his own skin. He's had a lot of change.
Yeah, he has. He's had a lot of upheaval for, you know, somebody who's really young.
I had the sense that Deming slash Daniel maybe sometimes thought about how much he'd lost and then would push those thoughts out of his head with the things he was involved in that weren't so healthy, with the drinking and the gambling and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think both he and Polly tend to do that. And it's, I think, their way of just dealing with things. For a lot of people, I think, you know, if we dwell on our pain or past hurts or traumas, how do we survive through the present day, right? You know, you can't think about it all the time. So it's kind of a survival method, I think, for Deming. He's trying not to think too much about it because it's just too hurtful. It's too painful for him to deal with. And, you know, he finally has to sort of confront some of it in order to move on.
He remains the kind of person, at least through the end of the novel, who is so steeped in two cultures that ironically, he will never fit perfectly into either one.
Yeah, yeah. He's sort of, you know, trying to choose, I think, kind of what path his life should take. And I think of the book very much as kind of a love story for New York. New York City plays a really big part in his life. It's kind of where he feels like he can belong.
That scene where the parents take him to a Chinese restaurant soon after his adoption, you get the sense that he's just hungry to speak his own language.
Yeah, he's so, you know, he feels starved, I think, starved for being seen, you know, and there's a line in it where he realizes after arriving in this small upstate, mostly white town, that he never realized how exhausting it was to be so conspicuous, because his whole life, you know, he was always not conspicuous. He was just another Chinese kid in the city, living in Chinatown or living in the Bronx, right? So it is very exhausting, I think, for him to kind of navigate these different identities, to deal with his own trauma, being new and being very different and being reminded of his difference. So when he returns to New York for that first visit, he's just, you know, he's like happy to be home. He's happy to be seen and to blend in. At the same time, he's now with his new adoptive family. And so he also kind of sticks out even more because he's a Chinese kid with white parents and people are looking at him.
Yeah, there's this irony to being conspicuous a lot and also being, you know, the more sensitive parts of him are invisible. Like people just literally don't recognize the pain that he's in.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of forced to keep a lot of that to himself. He's also really young. You know, he's like 11, 12 years old. So he doesn't maybe necessarily have the language to express how he's feeling. And he's not really given that space either.
And then when he's sent to this camp with other Chinese adoptees, American adoptees from China, that I want to make sure I don't get the language wrong, but he has nothing in common with them because most of them have been with their parents since infancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really different experience for him because he's 11 when he first moves in with his new adoptive family. So he's, you know, known his mother his whole life. And it's such a vastly different experience than children who are adopted as infants.
When you study literature, like, there are the classic conflicts, right? Like man versus nature. I couldn't decide if this book was man versus self or man versus society. It doesn't really fit exactly into either one. So I wonder how you would characterize the conflict here.
You know, it's kind of both, maybe. Man or woman. Person versus self and person versus society. I think they're both. But for the characters, for Polly and Deming, that sort of struggle with society also, you know, is so based in the self too, right? Their kind of interior or emotional journeys are kind of based on dealing with their own emotional and internal issues. And that in effect is a response and also a way of kind of dealing with how society sees them and how they fit into that.
The one thing that surprised me about Deming is that in some ways, it feels like a lot of his problems could be solved if he would just get openly angry at everyone and everything that has wronged him, whether intentionally or unintentionally. But it's just not his temperament.
Yeah, it isn't. And, you know, he's kind of like always struggling to please people. He doesn't want to let people down. He feels maybe if he lets people down, they'll leave him and he'll be all alone. So he ends up kind of going along with what people want for him and kind of suppressing his own self.
I wonder if you can talk about writing a first novel that you have lived with for 7 years, the moment when it's ready to be, you know, unleashed to the world, and it did very well commercially. Were you excited to start hearing from people who read it and hear what they took away? Were there things that readers picked out of it that you thought, I didn't intend for that to be there? And were there things that readers have overlooked?
You know, it's a really kind of terrifying and vulnerable time, I think, to take something that you've worked on alone for so long and have it now out in the world. Like, yeah. You know, publishing, when, you know, the minute you publish, the work no longer belongs to you. It belongs to the readers. And on one hand, that's all you've ever wanted. And on the other hand, it can feel very, you know, nerve-wracking in some ways, like you mentioned, in terms of how people will take it. Yeah, you know, I think there's been an incredible response from readers. I've heard from so many people, from parents, from immigrants, people from Fuzhou, the region of China where Polly is from transracial Asian American adoptees, who've all felt that they've related to the book and that parts of it have resonated with it. And that feels so meaningful to me as a writer. That's really all you ever want.
My guest is novelist Lisa Koh. Her new book is called The Leavers. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Are there people you grew up with that have read the book and said, oh, I get now that I messed up in dealing with you?
Not that explicitly. I think everybody in my life has probably read the book, from my parents to old teachers, childhood friends.
That must be exciting for old teachers.
Yeah, it is. It's really great. I loved it. I, you know, actually just spoke to my high school English teacher, who was really supportive of me, and he came to my book launch. It was really incredible. So, you know, I'm hoping that it kind of gives them insight, perhaps, into what it's like to have an experience different from their own. I guess that's kind of why we all read, too.
It seems risky to give it to your parents, who I'm sure are lovely people, but it's a work like a novel is a window into your brain and your heart and your experiences about things that you may not have talked to them about.
Yeah, you know, and that's sort of why I think so many fiction writers write fiction instead of memoir. You know, it's easier to kind of hide behind the characters. I mean, these characters are, you know, their experiences are so vastly different than my own. Though, you know, part of me is in those characters as well. It's a little blurry. It's hard to say. So, you know, I think that goes again to the kind of vulnerability part of it. People read it and think, oh, I know you. You're this character. You're that character. Maybe I'm all the characters and none of them at the same time.
Are your parents the kind of people who have, like, a copy on hand in case the mailman expresses interest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're enormously proud. I'm an only child, so, you know, they're super excited.
There is an interesting bond, I think, between only children and their parents that comes through in this book.
Yeah, that's a great thing that you picked up on. I realize, yeah, Deming and Polly are both only children. And I'm only child too. So, you know, maybe it felt easier for me to write that instead of writing about the world of siblings, which still feels kind of exotic and strange to me.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's just a different way of growing up and experiencing the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you have a much more intense kind of relation with your parents, especially, you know, Deming is raised with a single mom for most of his life. So, you know, he and Polly are pretty tight.
Are you still, you know, combing the headlines for material? Was that almost an accident that story that you got interested in inspired this work?
It was an accident. Yeah, it was just that I couldn't really stop thinking about it and was trying. I had some time to work on a new story or a new project, and that led to it. It wasn't that I was explicitly looking at headlines for inspiration, but sometimes inspiration comes in the ways that you don't expect. So I'm always keeping, you know, back then I would actually clip the newspaper clippings and put them in a folder. Now I feel like I just bookmark them or put them in my notes app on my phone.
How much did you enjoy the process of working on the book? I'm always interested. Sometimes you meet writers who say, oh, I hate everything about writing. I just am compelled to do it.
You know, it's wonderful at times and incredibly frustrating at other times. I did do a lot of research on it, and research can be a really great way to procrastinate, you know, in a way that you're like, I'm still working really hard. This is a necessary part of the process. But I also get to read things or talk to people, even, you know, travel to China to see where Polly's hometown was from. So there are kind of very enjoyable parts, I think, of being able to be a detective fulfill that kind of research nerd part of myself.
Did you really feel your Americanness in China?
Definitely. I don't speak the language. I don't speak Mandarin. I don't speak Fujianese. But I have a Chinese face. So I think that led to a lot of confusion with people who live there who would try to communicate with me. And then I felt like, you know, I couldn't say anything or get around. So it was challenging in its own way. But it was also a really great trip.
Did you feel like they were disappointed in you? Or?
Yeah, I think the reaction is really different, I think, being Chinese American or having a Chinese face than, you know, being white and you're kind of expected not to speak Chinese. But if you look Chinese, there's that expectation and it's, you know, understandable. So when you can't communicate, it's kind of like, what? Who are you? You know, where are you really from?
Did publishing your first novel change your identity?
You know, publishing is so different than writing. So it's been such a whirlwind year. And I think I've done so many events and spoke to so many readers, and that's kind of pushed me out of a comfort zone. You know, it's kind of the difference between the solitary work of writing and the very kind of public face of publishing, where you're talking and you're meeting people. And that's been really amazing.
Novelist Lisa Coe won the Penn Bellwether Prize for Fiction and was a finalist for the National Book Award for her debut novel, The Leavers. It's available now in paperback. Lisa, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Any podcast app will have the Think podcast, or you can go straight to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.